It's the takeaway for Tuesday, April 11th, 2017.
This is the takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's so confusing. You're told, get a good education. It's the key to a good job. You want to be a part of the prosperous growth economy that you hope is in all of our futures, right? But you took out a loan to get that veterinarian's degree or ancient Greek literature, be a rocket scientist, master's in Italian poetry of the Middle Ages. For their college majors, Americans owe $1.4 trillion in total student loan debt, according to the Federal Reserve. That's spread across more than 44 million borrowers. So, could someone out there, overwhelmed with student debt, be about to crash into insolvency and bring the rest of the global economy with them?
This is John in Philadelphia. Right now, my wife and I are paying back our grad school loan, and our interest rate is 6.9%, which is set by the federal government. We have excellent credit, but for some reason can't refinance at a lower rate, and despite the fact that I can never discharge this debt in bankruptcy, which makes it one of the least risky loans ever, I'm going to wind up paying about $70,000 more over the life of this loan because Congress won't set the rate at the same level that banks enjoy when they borrow from each other.
Okay, some reality on what turns out to be a very serious question. In 2016, the average grad held a little more than $37,000 in student debt. That's a 6% increase from 2015. The value of a higher education in this country is hard to argue with, but easy credit, rising tuition costs, and aggressive lenders are amounting to what may be an insurmountable task of paying that loan off. Down in the fine print of your own student loans, you may find the name Navient. They are the largest student loan provider in the country, and they've been accused of some very serious allegations, pushing borrowers into inadvisable borrowing practices and profiting off of private loans that were designed to fail. Navient has denied all wrongdoing, and they sent us a comment, which you can read in its entirety on our website. But the bubble question, and the even more important question of have you been pushed into going into more debt than you can handle, these questions are something our next guest can certainly handle. Betsy Mayotte is Director of Consumer Outreach and Compliance at the 60-year-old American Student Assistance Organization, a nonprofit that has been helping students since the 1950s. Betsy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi there.
One in four borrowers, in theory, could be affected by Navient's practices. You know, how do you know if you're someone who may be sitting on a Navient loan that some others have described as predatory?
Well, there's two different lawsuits here, and I want to make sure that we designate between the two. The one that was filed in January by the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau deals almost exclusively with federal student loans. And that is a much bigger population than the private student loan market, which is what the more recent lawsuit that was filed by the Illinois and Washington Attorneys General, I believe that was filed in March. So, you know, the most important thing is for a consumer to understand what kind of loans they have. And there's a really easy way to find that out. There's a website called the National Student Loan Data System. That website will list all of a borrower's federal student loans, who holds them, and what status they're in. If the borrower is trying to determine if they have private loans, the best way to find that out is through their credit report. And their credit report will also tell them who holds them. And at that point, they can tell whether they have a loan that was from Sallie Mae or Navient or not.
And in the case of these lawsuits and in some of the charges here that Navient was predatory, I mean, it wouldn't make sense for Navient to sign people up for loans that they really can't pay back. How does Navient profit from a scheme which actually might send students and borrowers into a bankruptcy at some point?
So, and that's what the big allegation is in the lawsuit by the Illinois and Washington Attorneys General's offices, is that it's alleged that Sallie Mae made loans that they knew were going to have a high default rate. These would be private student loans. And what they're claiming is that Sallie Mae did this in order to obtain access to the federal loan volume that also went through these particular institutions.
Now, you advise students, right, about, you know, the kinds of borrowing options that would be good for them, would be bad for them, the kinds of things that they should look at, right?
That's right.
So what do you define as a predatory loan practice that's basically taking advantage of a poor student that wants to go to a particular college but maybe doesn't have the capacity to actually pull it off?
Well, you know, I think, again, this comes down to consumer education. Anytime anyone is choosing a college and choosing a degree or certificate program to pursue, they should understand what the salary potential is once they complete that program. There's some great tools that are available today that weren't available as early as 3, 4, 5 years ago when the allegations in these lawsuits took place. These tools allow consumers to look at an institution and even as far down at the program level and look at the percentage of students that complete that program, the percentage of students that tend to default on their student loans, which is an indication that the loan might be unaffordable, and also the average loan debt. So we tell all consumers that are considering pursuing higher education of any kind is to look at the average starting salary in the career that they're pursuing and compare it and do a budget based on the average loan debt for students in that program in their school of choice. You know, as to whether a loan is predatory, I'm not an attorney, so it's difficult for me to define that from a legal sense. But, you know, again, I think families count on schools to be a trusted agent in guiding them in what a good loan product might be. Thankfully, there's some fairly new regulations that came into place right around 2008 that made sure that when schools do recommend a lender, whether it be a private loan product or another type of financial instrument, that there's no inducement or quid pro quo in that relationship. So I think things are a lot more transparent for consumers today than maybe they were back then.
This is really important and useful information. And we should note once again that Navient denies any wrongdoing. But I'm just thinking flashback here. 2008, countrywide predatory loan practices in real estate. All of a sudden, the bubble bursts and we have a recession. Could this controversy bring on a bubble in the student loan economy? And could it affect the rest of the economy? It's a lot of money.
It is a lot of money. There's a big difference, though, between mortgages and student loan products. There's definitely a parallel that we see with the allegations in the Illinois and Washington Attorney General's complaints and what we saw in the mortgage crisis in, you know, the mid-2000s. The difference between those two products, however, is that with a mortgage, there's collateral, which is the home. It's not good for the consumer, but there's the opportunity for the lenders to receive their funds back when they resell that collateral. Student debt, you can't repossess in education. Now, the federal loan programs are by far the majority of the student debt that's out there. And what we've seen in the past 10 years are multiple income-driven repayment plans being offered to federal student loan borrowers to ensure that not only the loans remain affordable because they're based on the student's income and their family size, but also there's a light at the end of the tunnel in the form of forgiveness. There's 4 or 5 income-driven plans that if you make payments under those plans for 20 or 25 years, any remaining balance is forgiven. There's also the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, where anyone with federal student debt who works for a government or nonprofit employer has the potential to have their debt forgiven after 10 years. So I think that's what makes the two things a little different, and I don't think we have necessarily that type of bubble economic risk associated with it.
Betsy Mayotte is Director of Consumer Outreach and Compliance at American Student Assistance. Thanks so much for all that information.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're talking about this at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
This is John Husner DeLand, and the fact that I have to have credit-shattering debt just to get an education is itself an affront to human decency.
Sequoia Jones, Columbia, South Carolina. On income-based repayment, by their calculations, I can pay $0. Try to buy a house. Can't get a home loan because I don't pay on the student loan. Really?
This is Ann from Minneapolis. When you get disabled as an adult and you have student loans, there is a provision within the student loan law that they are to be forgiven. Sallie Mae, otherwise known as Navient, does not always provide for that. And I applied for forgiveness in 2007. 2008-2009. Navient finally did forgiveness, but I found out a year later it was only half of my loans that were included.
Again, 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway. We did a great story yesterday about two women named Lisa Davis, accidentally connected, whose intersection turned out to be a very profound lesson on race in America. Lots of you have been telling us about your name doubles. Lisa wrote on Twitter, "I married a man and share a name with his ex-wife. Now have a mixed file tag on my credit report. It was not fun seeing her debt."
My name is Barbara. I'm from Portland, Oregon. And when I was in college, I went to get my financial aid check and was told I couldn't have it because I was failing all my classes, which was news to me because I thought I was doing fine. And it turned out there was another woman enrolled at the same college, same name, same birth date. Luckily, we had different Social Security numbers, and they were able to get it straightened out.
My name is Rebecca Martin, and I'm calling from Rhode Island. A few years ago, I was practicing attorney in Missouri, and I got a really irate phone call from another lawyer. And she was upset with me because she said I was trying to impersonate her. I was upset, obviously. And so I'm like, well, no, I am Rebecca Martin, and I'm an attorney. Long story short, we realized we had different bar numbers, and she never apologized.
This is Christine from Queens. The weird thing that happened with my name was that while I was in college, I met someone with my same first and last name. The thing was, and she was Caucasian, and I'm African-American. So we were so fascinated by that that we became pretty good friends, but we didn't stay in touch after college. I wonder what happened to her.
Ted sent us this on Twitter. My name is close to 49ers owner Jed York. Based on the tweets misdirected to me, I've learned he's not well-liked by 49ers fans.
My name is Martin Jerome Hess III from Dallas, Texas. I share my name with both my father and my grandfather, and that's not all that remarkable since I'm third. But I also share my name with a French young man. I met him on Facebook as someone tagged a picture of him as me. Now, he's the only other Martin Hest that I know of in the entire world, but he's a chocolatier.
This is Ken Dorsey from Long Island, New York. And before 2002, I was first page material on the Google search. Now that Miami quarterback superstar showed up, I'm lost in the Google search sauce. You can't even find me anywhere.
Love those stories. And for a long time, there was a John Hockenberry who worked as the chief counsel for the Washington Post organization. We'd call each other every once in a while. He was doing a lot better than I was. Give me a call if you got a story. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is supported by Bluevine, offering businesses revolving lines of credit to help them grow and to expand. Credit lines up to $100,000. Small business credit help is available at bluevine.com. And Enterprise Florida, working to promote Florida as a premier business destination for companies interested in relocation or expansion. More information at floridathefutureishere.com.
Tech CEOs and other corporate leaders were at the White House again today to talk economic policy. The Trump administration's policy to get more aggressive on H-1B visa fraud may be on the minds of some of the CEOs. The Department of Homeland Security will reportedly conduct more site visits, and there is a proposal to get rid of the longstanding H-1B lottery system altogether. The tech industry in particular relies on foreign-born talent, and executive Muhammad Ali is worried that life under Trump could be difficult for his employees. Ali is the CEO of the Boston-based company Carbonite, which provides data protection software and services. Ali and Kara Miller, the host of WGBH and PRI's Innovation Hub, joined us to talk about the new approaches that could make life difficult for 100 of Carbonite's 1,000 employees who were born outside the U.S., and about 30 of them who came to the country on H-1B visas.
These employees came to the United States to get an education. Many of them have MBAs. They're incredible employees. They would love to live here in the United States and stay here in the United States. But if their ability to travel, their ability to visit their families is curtailed, I think they're going to want to be in a place where they feel safe and secure. And this, I think this is a bigger problem. If you look at the economy as a whole, about half of America's Fortune 500 companies were founded by immigrants or children of immigrants. There was a sampling of $87 billion plus startups. More than half of them were founded by immigrants. If these people can't feel safe and secure here in America to start those companies, half of our economy over the next two decades is going to be in jeopardy.
How big is this in the broader economy? Tech isn't just tech. It's a lot of other workers.
Right. You know, when I talk to people about this issue of travel bans and travel restrictions and sort of the unknowable that now surrounds this, I see, you know, there's kind of two levels of fears. One level of fear is from workers themselves that Mohammed's been talking about, people worried, I may leave, I may not be able to get back in, or what if I'm not from a country that was on the initial banned list, but what if the list expands? But I think there's actually maybe an even greater fear from people who run companies and from cities and states where, you know, their natural resource is talent. Like, they're not sitting on a diamond mine. They don't have, you know, oil wells pumping. What they have is smart people. In Massachusetts, for example, as a test case, more than one in three jobs rely on tech. So some of that is pure tech jobs, but some of that is like the dry cleaner who wouldn't be in business if the people across the street at the tech company didn't drop off their dry cleaning or the coffee shop or whatever. I talked to Tom Hopcroft, who's the head of the Massachusetts Technology Leadership Council, and you'll hear he articulate some of this fear.
U.S. companies aren't going to stop hiring the best talent in the world. They're just going to hire them outside of the country. And so that brings with it, not only is that innovator not here, but all of the multiplier jobs that come with it. Their whole team may set up in the UK or somewhere else instead of here. And so that's taking jobs now away from, you know, U.S. people who might be in those support roles or those other assistive roles.
It sounds like the Department of Commerce needs to talk to the Department of Homeland Security.
Yes. I talked to someone I know who is venture capitalist in Silicon Valley. He's a Pakistani-American, got a PhD at MIT. And he said he's had four friends recently decide to start their companies in Dubai. And I think one thing that you hear repeatedly is there is a global war for talent. And it didn't just start last year or 2 years ago. It's been ramping up for a while. And so you've got London and Singapore and Hong Kong and all these places, Berlin, they want a piece of the action. And so if they can get it now more than ever, they're going to take it. And I think there's concern about that. I've heard people talk about moving science and engineering conferences, international conferences, out of the U.S. because if people from certain countries can't come or think it's too much of a hassle, what if I get detained? And they move those engineering conferences to other places. Not only is there kind of a support network of jobs around that, but it means the ideas are being exhibited not here anymore.
Mohammed, are we seeing the creation of a sort of offshore escape from immigration restrictions kind of business environment in places like Dubai, a sort of Cayman Islands of travel freedom?
Absolutely. But it's actually been going on for quite some time. And this spark is just encouraging it. And actually, our neighbor to the north has been one of the biggest recipients. Bill Gates started this in a big way in 2007 when he established a huge location in Vancouver because he was having immigration issues with hiring people in Seattle. And almost all the large companies, Facebook, Google, et cetera, have established large centers in Canada. And these types of executive orders and other immigration restrictions are just encouraging them to expand those centers. Carbonite has a center in Canada, and we are expanding that center in Canada.
And I'll just pick up on that Canadian thing, which is Canada is onto it. They have realized that they may get a lot of sort of high-tech talent coming their way. And another thing that we've seen now, this is on the early end of things, the indicator end, but we have seen, just in the last few weeks, reported that 40% of American colleges and universities are seeing dips in their international applications. Canada's are through the roof to Canadian colleges and universities. And Canada has long worked on a way to sort of pave the way from, oh, you've graduated with a degree here. Let us get you into graduate school. Let us make you have a PhD. Let us make you a citizen, right? And they want to figure out how to pave that way. And so I think there's a question about also budding talent, not just current, you know, developed talent.
So with the one voice, the Trump administration says we're bringing jobs back from Mexico, but at the same time with these kinds of restrictions, we're actually pushing them to Canada and other places around the world.
So I think the current administration policies are actually incredibly anti-job. And if you look at the sectors that really need the talent, it's really the new economy sectors. I mean, even in manufacturing, we're going from traditional manufacturing to tech-enabled manufacturing. We need that talent, and that talent has to occur domestically as well as come from the outside. There is really no initiative to expand our K-12, our apprenticeship program, our internship program. And so when I look at the policies that are on the table or about to come out, being talked about, they're actually incredibly anti-job in the long run.
Hitting close to home for Muhammad Ali, who's the CEO of Carbonite, based here in Boston. Also with us, Kara Miller, the host of WGBH and PRI's Innovation Hub. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Oh, sing it, Governor.
Once again, let me say, I do not plan to resign. I have done nothing illegal.
No, not that tune.
I have decided it is time for me to step down as Alabama's governor.
We lived our little drama. We kissed in a field of white and stars fell on Alabama last night.
Oh, sing it. After a long, slow, sultry ballad of a scandal, Alabama Governor Robert Bentley is out. Lieutenant Governor Kay Ivey was sworn in last night after Bentley resigned to avoid impeachment. He had been defiant, facing corruption charges and the revelation of an affair with one of his key advisors, all outlined in a 130-page report released by the state's House Judiciary Committee, claiming violations of state ethics and campaign laws to support the alleged infidelities. But is it over now? John Archibald is a columnist for the Alabama Media Group. John, welcome.
Alabama Blues. We've got it. Sweet home Alabama.
Yeah. Is this the end of the Bentley drama, if we can quote the lyrics?
No, it's just the first verse for sure. We have more criminal investigations proceeding. We have a lot of the whole political machinery is on pins and needles waiting to see what happens, but we're far from over.
Now, he took a plea deal. I'm wondering if his senior political advisor and the person he's alleged to have had the affair with, Rebecca Caldwell Mason, was as defiant as he was.
Well, there's no question about that. She has been not allowed on premises, shall we say, for quite a while. But, I mean, his speech in resigning sounded more like a retirement speech than a resignation.
The time has come for me to look at new ways to serve the good people of our great state.
And so it made a lot of us here wonder if Rebecca Mason had written it, because in addition to being the reason he was brought down, she was also a terrible political advisor. So it sounded a lot like something she might have written.
So what are the possible penalties, independent of just leaving office, that are faced by the governor? And what's Lieutenant Governor Kay Ivey to do?
Well, the governor could face some jail time. Conceivably, it's up to the judge's discretion on that. But in reality, that's not going to happen. He's going to walk away. I mean, he's lost his family and his job and his legacy and everything. So that, I think, some think is punishment enough. Kay Ivey, interestingly enough, stepped in yesterday and sounded far more gubernatorial on her way in than Bentley sounded on the way out.
Today is both a dark day in Alabama, but yet also it's one of opportunity. I ask for your help and your patience as together we steady the ship of state and improve Alabama's image. These are my first priorities as your governor of the 54th governor of the state of Alabama.
She'll face some skepticism, but she's got a lot of mess to clean up that he left behind.
Would that include a mess in the party?
Well, interestingly enough, and Alabama is a supermajority Republican state, so it's conflict in the party is what passes for a two-party system. But interestingly enough, this state really has been more unified, and that party has been more unified in recent days than it has been in a long time, all in requesting Robert Bentley to resign. So I think the party believes, you know, it's time to move on together now that the prodigal father is gone.
So former Governor Bentley has brought them together in Alabama, and the long state nightmare is over. Is that the good way of saying it?
The nightmare is over, and the nightmare begins.
John Archibald is a columnist for the Alabama Media Group. Thank you so much, John.
Sure, John.
We lived our little drama.
More drama? Well, today a special election in Kansas may take the pulse of U.S. voters reacting to the Trump first 100 days. Kansas's 4th congressional district holds a special election to fill the seat left vacant by former Representative Mike Pompeo, who resigned in January to become the Trump CIA director. This has been a safe GOP seat for 2 decades, but you wouldn't know that from a recent influx of worried Republican spending. 3 candidates in the running: Republican Ron Estes, who's well-known in Kansas. He's a former state treasurer. Democrat James Thompson, a civil rights attorney. And Libertarian Chris Rockhold, who's also a pilot. Deborah Schar is a reporter at KMUW in Wichita. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So, Deborah, is that GOP money worried money?
That's what some of the political analysts and professors locally here are saying. You know, this race was really just humming along for the past couple of months. And then last week, everything started picking up a huge pace. The National Republican Congressional Committee put about $100,000 into some last-minute campaign ads to support Ron Estes, the Republican candidate. And then from there, we had Ted Cruz stopping by yesterday here in Wichita to do a campaign rally for Ron Estes. And then there was also reportedly some robocalls that were recorded by Vice President Mike Pence and even President Donald Trump that were going out today to get voters to actually get to the polls on this special election day.
So Estes's connection with Trump is seen by the GOP as an asset. I'm wondering what Democrats are doing as a response strategically to possibly make this seat in play.
Well, I think that's what the analysts thought with Ron Estes' campaign strategy. You know, they had a short amount of time to really get out and campaign and get the voter support, only about 8 weeks since they were nominated until today. And so during that short amount of time, you saw the Democratic candidate James Thompson really out in force in the community. He attended a lot of campaign forums. He was at voter events, a lot of public discussion. Ron Estes, the Republican candidate, attended some of those, but not all of them. And the Libertarian candidate also attended some, but not all. And so he really tried to engage the voters throughout the district, James Thompson, the Democrat. The analysts think that Ron Estes was relying a little bit on his name recognition and his solid experience here in the state as state treasurer. And then again, as you mentioned, as the Sedgwick County treasurer, which is the populous county here in the 4th congressional district.
So complacency may have worked against the Republican Ron Estes. I'm wondering if Chris Rockhold, the Libertarian, splits the Republican vote and may be a problem for Estes.
No, I don't think so. You know, in terms of the early voting that we saw here in Sedgwick County that just wrapped up, they had 22,000 people who voted by mail or in person during the early voting period. And it was split about 9,000 votes or so for each of the Democrat or Republican voters that participated. And the Libertarians had less than 100 votes cast during that early voting time. So I don't think the Libertarian voters are really a factor in this race.
So if Thompson wins here, he will really emerge as a Democrat to watch. But what do you make of any of these special elections? I mean, it's really hard to extrapolate.
Well, this is the first congressional election since Donald Trump was elected back in November, and there will be 4 more coming through June. And so the professor that I spoke to yesterday from Wichita State thought that this would really kind of set the stage with the enthusiasm in the Republican Party, depending on how the vote goes here. He thought that if the Democrat James Thompson had a fair amount of showing in this race, then it would show you that there is something going on with the electorate here in South Central Kansas. And it's showing you that maybe people aren't as satisfied with the Republican politics that are going on here statewide and here locally as well. And so the results will actually indicate where people's thoughts are about how the county and the state is going.
So Democrat James Thompson doesn't have to really win this race in the 4th district to make a headline in the results tomorrow. Deborah Schar is a reporter at KMUW in Wichita, Kansas. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Taking a plea is one of the scariest Wild West roll-the-dice casino elements of America's criminal justice system. Aggressive cops and prosecutors can get powerless defendants with only court-appointed lawyers to confess even when they believe they are innocent or have a court case. There are even some strange, arcane details in the plea process where a defendant can both cop a plea and maintain their innocence at the same time. It's known as an Alford plea, and it's at the heart of this week's Case in Point from the Marshall Project. The story goes like this. Kyle Breeden was murdered in 1998, shot in the head twice, and his body was dumped into the Kentucky River. With no real leads, Susan King, an ex-girlfriend of the deceased, was looked at for a time, but lacking evidence, investigators were unable to even obtain a warrant to search her home. The case went cold until an aggressive detective with the Kentucky State Police, Todd Harwood, got involved. Andrew Cohen, senior editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point, joined the defendant in this complicated and heartbreaking case, Susan King, to explain.
The initial investigation didn't go anywhere. It was so weak, there was so little evidence pointing to Susan King, that a judge wasn't even willing to grant a search warrant of her house. So it gives you a sense, when a judge doesn't issue a warrant in a murder case, because the judge isn't convinced that there's enough to go on, there's enough probable cause, it tells you that there's a problem with the investigation. And so without that search warrant, the investigation into Susan King really didn't go anywhere. 7 years later, this new detective is on the case, and he essentially omits from a new affidavit critical facts that tend to exonerate Susan King. And because he does that, he does get the search warrant. And then, lo and behold, there's nothing that is found that's terribly incriminating towards Susan King. So again, there's another search warrant, and again, they find bullets that don't match the bullets found in the brain of the victim. And again, they find blood that they can't really link to the victim, and so on and so forth. And in spite of that, the case moves forward to a murder trial. Now, we have holes in the story that maybe this upcoming federal trial will tell us. Why did the prosecutor believe the police so much down the line? Why wasn't there sort of an independent investigation of the evidence to evaluate the case before it got as far as it did? But none of those things happened. And that's why Susan King ended up for 6.5 years in prison. And that's why, when eventually there was an actual confession from a serial killer who said, yeah, I committed that crime, the Kentucky courts were willing to let her go.
Susan, when did you come to the conclusion that you were going to have to take some kind of a plea because the wheels of so-called justice were against you here?
My lawyer had me convinced that if I didn't take that plea that they were offering, she said that I'd go back into county jail and stay there for years while I try to get away from a hung jury.
And so you went from, this is an unfortunate, sad thing that happened back in 1998, to, oh my gosh, they think I did this, to, oh my gosh, I better take a plea or else I'm going to go to prison for life?
Yeah, well, see, your average person doesn't know stuff like this. And I didn't. I'm just your average Joe. I didn't know any of this legal stuff. I didn't know.
And listen, John, as terribly unfortunate as this is, Susan King actually is lucky that she took an Alford plea, and I'll explain that in a second, as opposed to just a regular old-fashioned guilty plea. Because it was the fact that it was an Alford plea that in the end helped clear her, and indeed is helping her still. It's one of the critical factors that the federal appeals court last month cited to allow her malicious prosecution case against this detective to proceed. An Alford plea is when you say to the judge and to the prosecutor and really to the public, I am willing to plead guilty, but I am maintaining my innocence. And courts accept that. So Susan King was able to take the plea. She got sort of a lesser sentence than she might have gotten had she gone to trial. But in the end, the fact that it was that special kind of plea that's recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court really helped her.
Do Alford pleas help the prosecution or defendants in any of these cases?
I think they help the administration of justice, to be honest, right? I mean, prosecutors accepted it. They knew it was happening because it got the case off the docket, right? It got them a win. They were able to say that there was a guilty plea. They were able to have a sentence. They were able to not have to roll the dice in what essentially was a terribly weak case. And they could say that they solved the murder. In fact, the detective who is now a defendant in this civil rights case got a commendation for his detective work in the case before it all fell apart. We live in a plea deal country. We've talked about this before, John, where the vast majority of criminal cases end up in a plea deal. This was one of those cases. I think with a more aggressive defense attorney, maybe Susan King goes to trial. The problem with that is it's easy for us to say, because if you go to trial in a murder case in Kentucky, a high-profile one, you run the risk of being convicted even if you're not guilty.
Susan King, what did you lose while you were spending that time in prison?
Well, I come out with my mind, but that's about all I came out of there with. I lost my house. My house was paid for, too. My house at 6.5 acres, my beauty shop. I lost my cosmetology license because I couldn't get them renewed while I was in prison. I lost my job. I lost my animals. I lost everything, and I lost all them years, too, with my dad. He's getting old, and my son, and there were deaths in my family. I just missed everything. It was just hopeless. I felt like I was just doomed because I didn't have a lawyer to help me.
At what point did 10 years in jail seem like a good deal to you, Susan?
It never did. When I got up there that morning that I had to take a plea, I still didn't know what I was going to say. As I didn't want to say guilty because I wasn't guilty. But I didn't want to say not guilty, or she said they'd put me back in county jail if I said not guilty.
What do you think you're going to say about all this when it's in your rearview mirror, Susan?
Well, there was a whole lot of bad things went on by a whole lot of important people. Did a lot of bad things, and I've let them in my shoe, not theirs. But right now, I'm just, me and God are working on this, and I've got to learn how I'm going to forgive.
Susan King, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew Cohen, as always, senior editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
Andrew Cohen of the Marshall Project reached out to the Kentucky State Police for comment but did not receive a response. To read the full article, please visit themarshallproject.org. Finally this hour, is the federal government a useful partner in enforcing and enacting police reforms? Last Friday, the city of Baltimore became the 20th city in the U.S. to sign a consent decree with the federal government, instituting a series of reforms in the city's police department. We spoke with Baltimore Mayor Catherine Pugh that day about what the city hoped to accomplish.
We are prepared to do what is necessary to make our citizens safe, to make our police department safe, to provide the tools that are necessary and the training that is necessary so that we can have the best police department and the best interaction between community and police going forward.
But it is unclear if under the Trump administration, this consent decree mechanism, which goes back to the 1990s, will be pursued or discarded. Long before the most recent focus on police brutality, before the deaths of Freddie Gray and Michael Brown, or the growth of the Black Lives Matter movement, the city of Pittsburgh came under scrutiny following the 1995 death of a black businessman who died of asphyxiation during a struggle with white police officers in the city's suburbs. Pittsburgh's consent decree expired in 2002, and Cheryl Gay Stolberg, domestic affairs correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, looked at the track record in Pittsburgh and where the whole consent decree idea came from.
A consent decree is simply as it sounds. It's an agreement. It's an agreement between two parties. And in this case, John, we're talking about consent decrees to reform police departments. And there's a very specific history to that. The history grows out of the 1991 beating of Rodney King, an unarmed black man in Los Angeles. He was beaten by four LAPD officers. It was captured on video, on very grainy television footage, and it led to widespread outrage across the country, and particularly in Washington, where Congress held hearings on how to address police misconduct. And lawmakers inserted a very tiny provision known as Section 1414 into a crime bill signed into law by President Clinton. Hmm. And it authorized the Attorney General to investigate and sue to eliminate any pattern or practice, those are important words, pattern or practice of unconstitutional violations of civil rights by law enforcement officers. And when the Attorney General does investigate, these suits lead to consent decrees, agreements between the federal government and cities and their police departments to reform.
So broadly speaking, this is a mechanism for the federal government to have oversight on local law enforcement. What's the track record of actually reforming and doing a good job of what they intended?
So the track record is mixed, and I think experts would say it's gotten better over time. I went to Pittsburgh to look at the very, very first consent decree, which was reached in 1997, and it turned Pittsburgh into a model department, but only for a while. Over time in Pittsburgh, the chief, who was a reformer, got fired. The union balked at the reforms. A new mayor came in. Some of these reforms fell out of use. One of the chief's, the reform-minded chief's successors, wound up going to prison during a corruption scandal. So the only way to assess that particular consent decree is to say that it didn't stick. But others have been hailed as a success, particularly in Los Angeles. A consent decree was examined by a Harvard study. Harvard called it the most ambitious police reform experiment in America and said it led to widespread reforms. And in other cities like Seattle, which is just coming out of its consent decree, there's been agreement that these reforms have led to real changes.
Within the Justice Department, is there a group that believes that this is a useful mechanism? Is there any way of determining whether, for instance, Jeff Sessions and the lawyers and the legal team around Attorney General Sessions thinks this is a good way of actually enforcing reform within police departments?
Well, when we think about consent decrees, they've actually fallen in use and out of use over time. And you need to think about the philosophical dispute over the shape and size and scope and role of the federal government, because that plays into this debate that we're having over consent decrees. Clinton used them. George W. Bush pretty much abandoned them. The Obama Justice Department really brought them to a high art form. And now, as you mentioned, we're seeing Attorney General Jeff Sessions saying, you know, I don't think this is the way to go. Sessions regards consent decrees as a massive overreach of federal authority. I think as a conservative, he's inclined to believe that the federal government has no business meddling in local police departments. That's actually what George W. Bush believed. He used that word. So within the Justice Department, there are certainly lawyers, you know, line lawyers who believe that these consent decrees can be a very effective reform tool. And many police chiefs believe that they can be a very effective reform tool. But I think the question among conservatives and people like Sessions and Donald Trump is it a tool that we should use? Is it the heavy hand of the federal government intervening where it has no business?
And in general, it would be correct to say that this is a mechanism that has a very partisan record, used almost exclusively by Democrats and not so much at all by Republicans.
Absolutely. And if you think of it as that sort of, you know, the philosophical inclination, right? Democrats tend to be more philosophically inclined to use government as an instrument to advance social change. Republicans tend not to be. So it's the same thing with these consent decrees. Consent decrees are instruments of the courts. So what happens in a consent decree is the parties reach an agreement, and then a federal judge steps in to monitor reforms. And these reforms can be very aggressive, and they can require police departments to spend money, for instance, and money that a lot of times cities might say they don't have. Unions don't like them. The police unions don't like them because they say consent decrees are a way to do an end run around a bargaining agreement. They allow chiefs to discipline officers who, you know, might otherwise have more expansive rights under their union contracts. So there's this whole clash around, you know, the philosophy of it, as well as whether or not they're effective. But I think by and large, experts would say they can be very effective.
But just to emphasize that point you made, police view them as very much anti-police.
Many police view them as very much anti-police. Many chiefs are embracing consent decrees. If you look at Baltimore, where there were riots in 2015 over the death of Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old black man, in Baltimore, the then mayor, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, invited the Justice Department in, and the current chief, Commissioner Kevin Davis, is very much in favor of this consent decree. And even in Baltimore, the union actually cooperated with Justice Department investigators in Baltimore. The union is not as keen maybe on this consent decree, but Baltimore is a really good example of how the Justice Department at the very end of the Obama administration kind of figured out a way to bring the parties together and even to bring the police unions, the police union in. Although, by and large, unions have not been fans of consent decrees, and unions, the police union backed Donald Trump for that very reason in 2016.
A historical look at the consent decree as a mechanism for enforcing reform in police departments. Cheryl Gay Stolberg is domestic affairs correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much, Cheryl.
Thanks, John.
All right, we got you thinking, right? So give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Comment on anything in the program. Find us at The Takeaway to tweet us. And if you want to take The Takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Bluevine, offering businesses revolving lines of credit to help them grow and to expand. Credit lines up to $100,000. Small business credit help is available at bluevine.com. And by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.